that down. All right, that's already something. I guess it would be a bit of a project there, but interesting, very interesting, project, and I'll think on it. And in fact, I understand there are a few of them that are coming online now that are fairly reasonable. Basically, we'll get a basic unit, supply the scope or whatever, however they're doing it now. I understand a couple of them. But, I was just really curious. It works excellent. I have no complaints. But, this is the one time that I actually can't do what I like as far as analysis. Very hard to do an analysis on a loop antenna. You can't really do a modeling job on it because modeling programs don't seem to take into consideration. And all kinds of anything based on a straight dipole type of configuration, no problem. When it comes to loops, you have different stories. So, all right, we'll have to think on that. Because I was going to ask you if the formula for antenna efficiency could actually be fit into this if basically I'm just going to apply radiation resistance, but I see I've got to do a lot more than that. Go ahead, Rich. You pick it up.
I should have said question on this subject. Dick, what you're talking to Mel about was equivalent circuits and opens and shorts. It sounds almost, maybe I'm off base, but does this have anything to do with a 7-in equivalent, the 7-in equivalent circuit, black box concepts?
Yes, it does, Rich. But every good modern vector network analyzer, you could say some of the time it acts like a 7-in equivalent circuit. Some of the time it acts like a Norton equivalent circuit. A 7-in equivalent circuit is just a way of representing a signal generator. Every real signal generator has a certain internal impedance, which may or may not be 50 ohms. When you dial the attenuator on the front panel to a high enough number, every good signal generator does look like very close to 50 ohms. You take almost anybody's signal generator and go flat out the highest possible signal, where you're looking straight into the final stage of the amplifier, or you're looking straight into the oscillator that's inside your signal generator. In that case, almost never are they 50 ohms. But even in that case, you can make an equivalent circuit. A 7-in equivalent really means you have an ideal oscillator with 0 ohms input impedance. You connect in series with it a resistor, and you put those two things inside of a black box. And if you've done the job correctly, the 7-in equivalent, the perfect signal generator, 0 ohm impedance, with some resistor in series with it, will act exactly like your real signal generator. You have those two boxes side by side, you let a guy make a whole bunch of measurements, he can't tell the difference. And even though your real signal generator is a voltage generator with some kind of a resistor buried somewhere inside, you can represent it with an ideal signal generator, a perfect voltage generator, or a perfect battery with 0 ohm impedance, so to speak, and a certain resistor in series. A 7-in equivalent circuit doesn't have to be AC. Works beautifully on DC circuits. Your real battery has some kind of an internal resistance to it. That dry cell you pick up that runs your flashlight might have an internal impedance of 0.05 ohms. I could represent that in a black box diagram as a perfect 1.5 volt battery with 0 ohm input impedance on the battery, equivalent signal generator, so to speak, with a 0.05 ohm resistor in series, put them in a black box, and I can't tell the difference between it and a real battery. What's hard to believe is that that's what a real battery is very close to. The 7-in equivalent is very close to what a real battery is. I can make a Norton equivalent. I can make a perfect constant current generator with just the right resistor across it, and I put that into a third black box, and you can't tell the difference between the other two black boxes. Every real simple signal generator that produces one signal, whether it be DC or AC, there's three ways you can represent it. You can write that
repeat. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
You can write down the schematic diagram of your real signal generator. You can make a simplified diagram, which is a Thevenin equivalent. That's the one with a voltage generator and a resistor in series. Or you can make an equivalent diagram of a Norton generator, which is a constant current generator with a resistor in parallel. You put all three of those in three separate black boxes, and you can't tell the difference. Beautiful equivalent circuit. Depending on what you're doing, sometimes when you're studying your particular complicated circuit, it's really got two signal generators, and it's got two different loads, and it's got some reactants and whatever. By making Thevenin and Norton equivalents for the various signal generators in your complicated circuit, there are times when the net result is a hell of a lot simpler, and you can easily understand it. Now, getting back to Mel's case, almost every good network analyzer, vector network analyzer I can get a hold of these days, the one I use now is a Rohde & Schwarz that goes up to 8 gigahertz. I think it goes down to 100 kilohertz. In theory, if I could smuggle that Rohde & Schwarz vector network analyzer out of that salt mine and walk it over to Dover Street and connect it directly to your 600 ohm open wire line, and then during the CAL procedure, I connect a 600 ohm resistor at the end of your open wire line, I then connect a short circuit, I then connect an open circuit, and I press the three calibration buttons on the vector network analyzer, then I connect your real antenna. It will know where the end of your feed line is. It'll know how many wavelengths is out there. It'll know what impedance conversion the feed line is giving you. It'll therefore plot directly on the screen the exact impedance of your antenna. So if you can find somebody who has touch capability of a real modern-day vector network analyzer, I don't care if it's made by Hewlett-Packard, Rohde & Schwarz, Agilent, Enritsu, any of the good brand names, you get your hands on one of those, smuggle it for 1 hour, so to speak, to Dover Street, and you'll know exactly what the impedance of your antenna is. As an academic experiment, that would be fun to do. With difficulty, you have the hardware in your basement now to do that, Mel. I didn't say it's easy, but you have the resources after a little bit of study, and this is considerably easier than what you've already done that's damn hard, and that is to make a crystal lattice quartz filter. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger,
this is
W2ORY. Well, I'm not doing no more smuggling. Well, those things are gone anyhow. I haven't got the access to it anymore, but I borrowed a spectrum analyzer or an HP at the time, and I had almost a nervous breakdown that weekend. I borrowed for a weekend to do some work here. That time I was building that receiver, so I wanted to use the spectrum analyzer, if you remember, when I was working on the synthesizer and all. And I can say I had a nervous condition that weekend because that thing, at that time, I think would have cost me my year's income from the company. They were costly as all heck, though. So I guess I'll loaf along as I am and see if I can eventually, come up with something. Like I say, it's a lot of information that, you can really pick up, and it's interesting information. So this whole thing with the loop antennas, whether they be receiving loops, transmitting loops, the whole business, it opens a whole new world, and there is a lot of people on there that are coming on, and now it seems to be that they're even jumping for a number of different versions of antennas on 75-160 either. Loop antennas, or half squares, inverted Vs, or whatever, the few guys that have come on with verticals, that is, very far and few between verticals, or of course, few of these, I would say the vast majority of Sirius 75 meter guys that are on right now are using some form of a seems like one form of a loop or not seems to be the ideal antenna, because not so much that they're looking to work the X, they would like to talk to all their buddies all over the 200 miles radius. This is basically what the 75 meters is falls into. You go every few kilohertz, you can hear a nightly group that gets together, take over.
WHWW.
Your audio is very loud, Howie. First we got the Joe. Joe, you wanted to make a comment? Go ahead.
Actually, I wanted to ask you a question directly related to the subject. Using something like what you're describing, a network analyzer, and going through your CAL procedure, CALing at the end of a test cable, probably something like a phase-stable cable. Here's my question for you. You say connect an open, connect a short, and connect a load. Would you want to do that by hand-typing those devices, or would you rather torque those devices on it to get repeatability?
Okay. It's nice if it is a phase-stable cable made for test procedure, a cable that's known to be rugged and it's not going to go up and down in length as a function of temperature and bending and whatever. Doesn't have to be. You can use a radial piece of RG58 cable if you're careful. Make a great big bend if you calibrate. Of course, the data is going to develop some error. So the magic is not in the cable. The magic is in the computer program. It's inside the vector network analyzer. That's point number one. Point number two, let me show you something else now that I think about it some more, Mel. Assuming you've got an AEA impedance measuring device, an antenna impedance analyzer, you can make a measurement in the shack at your end of the 600 ohm open wire line. Assuming your AEA antenna analyzer is properly calibrated, I'd like to believe it's going to tell you total VISWAR, that's the easy part. If it's a good one, it's going to tell you the resistive component and the reactive component. If it told you your antenna looks like, in the shack, 750 ohms resistance with plus J 25 ohms, 25 ohms of inductive reactance and 750 ohms of resistance, I know you can put a dot on the Smith chart of that measured impedance. Step number one. Step number two, you know how many feet of cable you've got. You're at 600 ohm line. You go out there with a ruler and you measure it. And for your particular case at 80 meters, you measure it to the nearest 3 feet. That's good enough. You know how many feet of cable you've got. You know the cable is very close to 600 ohms impedance. You can set up your Smith chart to not reference 50 ohms, but reference 600 ohms. You know that your particular, assuming your feed line is low in loss, you know that all possible frequencies, all possible lengths of cable are going to be represented by a constant radius circle on that Smith chart where the Smith chart has been set up for 600 ohms. So you've got a dot for the measurement you made in the shack. Let me drop. You've got a 600 ohm real line. You've got a 600 ohm calibrated Smith chart, so to speak. You take your compass and you swing a circle on the Smith chart. From the center, you set the compass between the center and that dot that you've measured with your AEA, and you swing a circle. You know that the real impedance of your antenna is somewhere on that circle. You know how many feet of cable you've got. You therefore know what fraction of a wavelength that cable is, the 600 ohm open wire line. You go counterclockwise on that circle, that number of degrees, that number of wavelengths. And you make a new dot. That is the impedance of your antenna. You've taught us how to use a Smith chart. The Smith chart you taught us about was always a 50 ohm Smith chart. Nothing magic about 50 ohms. The Smith chart has got a zero in the center and a unity out to the perimeter. You could make it 50 ohms in the center and to the left is zero ohms and to the right is infinity on the outer circle. Well, you can tell the Smith chart, hey, you're a 600 ohm Smith chart. After that, you swing that circle and you'll know. That's the poor man's vector network analyzer. You've got the technology. Before I give it over to Howie, I wonder if that made some sense to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
No problem if I could plot it on the Smith chart. Yes, of course, you could change easily to change the Smith chart around. I think I, in fact, plotted a tutelage. I basically mentioned that. Now, but the point is, you say take the AEA. How do I get this AEA, which is meant for only got this connector on the end and for 50 ohms, a PL259 on the end there, or an SO239, you know, chassis mount. That's it. How am I connecting this? I didn't quite understand. How am I connecting that APA analyzer onto the 600 ohm line? That's where I lost the disc over.
It's your transformer, Alan.
Give that man a cigar. There's about three or four different ways you can connect it, Mel. You can dumbly directly connect it. By that I mean you can take your two wires of the 600 ohm line, connect one of them to the outer ring and one of them to the center conductor of your SO239 or PL259 that's on the AEA. That's a slightly crude way, but it will give you an answer that's close. The next step in improvement is to put a real matching transformer in there. You could have a primary winding and a secondary winding. You could make it a one-to-one transformer, and that way it is a perfect one-to-one balance. So you make a transformer that works at 3.7 megacycles. It's got primary windings and secondary windings, the same number of windings. You connect the primary directly across the AEA and connect the secondary directly across the 600 ohm open wire line. That's one step improved as far as now making a properly balanced measurement on your 600 wire open line line. 600 ohm open wire line. The next level of improvement would be to make a balance which has got a 12-to-1 ratio to it, which is square root of 12, which is roughly 3.5 or so. There's 3.5 more turns on the secondary than there is on the primary. And now that balance transformer, probably built with a toroid, the primary winding with a smaller number of windings goes directly to the AEA. The secondary winding with a larger number of windings goes to the 600 ohm line. Now the AEA is making a measurement, but whatever it measures, you have to multiply it by 12 because it's got a 3.5 voltage step-up ratio. It's got a 12-to-1 impedance step-up ratio. But still, you can handle that. So you got at least three different ways. You can connect that AEA to your line, make the measurement with your Smith chart that is made to be a 600 ohm Smith chart. You can then put at least one dot, swing a circle, put the second dot. You'll know the impedance of your antenna at that frequency. And you can repeat the whole procedure at all the other frequencies of 80 meters if that's what you want to know. I know you can make this measurement if you want it bad enough, Mel. And as a science experiment, it would be kind of fun. Let's see what Howie's got to add or ask about this. Go ahead, Howie. Don't speak too loud. K2LIW. We got time.
All right, Dick. For the first part of my comment is, I don't know if I really would want to take a very expensive spectrum analyzer and hook it up to an antenna that size, because if you've got 600 ohm line, you've got the loop out there, what about static buildup? I'd be worried about blowing it up. Number two, couldn't you use a noise bridge to do his impedance measurement?
You said spectrum analyzer, you meant vector network analyzer, and you're absolutely right. You put a big static charge in the front panel of a network analyzer, you're probably going to damage its so-called voltage probe, diode probe network that's in there. Yes, a noise analyzer, a properly calibrated and used noise analyzer will allow you to measure the resistive component and the reactive component. In order for this to really work, you don't want to know just the VISWR. You want to know how much ohms in resistance, how much ohms in reactance, and you want to know if the ohms or reactance is capacitive or inductive. So you want to know the separate components of impedance, the R value and the X value. Once you've got that, you can now put a dot on a Smith chart. And as far as the static charge getting into the network analyzer is concerned, a fairly simple expedient on that one would be simply to put an RF choke across it. The balancing transformers with toroids, with the primary winding and the secondary winding that we just described, it is a beautiful static charge discharger. You connect that balance in the antenna first, it discharges any voltage that's left, DC voltage that's left on the antenna. DC-wise, those transformers are a short circuit. Then you connect it to the network analyzer. So that's a safe procedure. Oh, by the way, don't make the measurement on a day with a thunderstorm going by Manhattan Beach. Avoid that particular day of measurement. So, with an AEA, and maybe either directly connecting to make a crude measurement or with a set of toroid transformers to do impedance matching and balancing, either 1-to-1 or 12-to-1. I know you can make this measurement, Mel. And you know the length of cable you've got. You know the impedance of the cable. You can therefore plot all this on the Smith chart, and you can find out exactly what your antenna is doing. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck net.
KP2QIQ.
Correct for velocity constant.
Easy. He knows the velocity factor of his 600 ohm open wire line. He knows it to two decimal places. Glenn, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, actually, over like the last 2 years, I've done a lot of these measurements, and I've actually not only used my MFJ analyzer up on the roof with a balun and without a balun, and also dragged up a vector network analyzer up on the roof with me and an oscilloscope. And what I did is here's some of the results that I found. You can use the analyzer direct on the wire, and the information is really, really close. It's not that different. Before I put the network analyzer on there, I used the oscilloscope just to look at what kind of voltages were on the antenna, and I guess on a relatively calm day, the voltage there didn't look too nasty, so I actually did plug it into the front end of the analyzer, and very, very similar data between I could get some little phase components and everything like that over a wider frequency range, which is a little bit nicer. One interesting thing about the balun is, though, when you put the balun in, it does give you some capacitance error that you normally don't see if you just go directly to the antenna. And it's normally the wire by itself is mainly L and R. And when you use the balun, you can get this like wacky C component that winds up in there. Back over to you, Dick, KP2QIQ.
Yeah, when the wind blows past your antenna on a dry day, a static charge is built up on the antenna. If you were foolish enough to directly connect your digital voltmeter to there, you might survive and you might damage the digital voltmeter, but you'd measure some pretty nice voltages at times. By simply putting an RF choke across the antenna terminals, you can get rid of the DC voltage. If the RF choke was ideal at your frequency, it would be an impedance that's very high, and it would be a very minor perturbation. Your real RF choke has either got some stray inductance or stray capacitance to it, and you can measure what is the impedance of your RF choke. And therefore, after you finish making your measurement, you can crank out the error. You can crank out the error that was created by your RF choke. So you can make this as accurate as you like. You can recognize each of the things that are making the measurement less than ideal. You can measure each one of those things, like the RF choke, and you can crank it back out. A smart guy with a network analyzer who measures 750 ohms of resistance and 0 ohms of reactance, and he knows that his particular RF choke is really creating a 1,000 ohm resistance component, so to speak, with a little bit of mathematics, he can crank that back out and find out that the antenna was really 2,000 ohms. So, I hope you've got enough power to override this dead carry that we've got on frequency here, Mel. I'm going to pass it over to you, K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So that's exactly, first of all, let's back up. When I did the original measurements, that's what I said, how I came up with the original measurements. I did use the RX noise bridge, and that's how I measured it. I didn't think that I was going to get the kind of accuracy, because it's very strange that ATA, graphic analyzer, I tried it on, I thought it's, Googling with this one time, and I found that if I went up to a resistance of about, say, around 300 ohms, I wanted that time I was thinking of measuring something that uses ribbon cable. It looked crazy what the graphic display on it just went nuts, like bouncing all over the place, little dots, breakups, and all kinds of things. It didn't seem to work correctly. Maybe it's, a little bit asking the instrument to do a little bit too much. I mean, it's still a handheld analyzer, it's not a multi, thousands of dollars, it's a thing, hundreds of dollars. So I did revert back to my old-fashioned column arm. I happen to have here a column arm RX noise bridge. And I did fail to determine the number of factors on it. And that's how I came up with, 5,000 ohms, approximately. But the only point there is that, I guess you could, it's very hard to get up there. Yes, I'd love to, but I can't get up. I can't disconnect the feed line. There's 4-1 meter wire. That's it. I hate to go up there and start cutting, the feed line. I mean, I can't even get out of that spot. It's all the way up there. It's just hanging out in the middle of nowhere. So I was trying to actually really determine what is at that insulator without 35 feet of the open wire dropping down, the 600 ohm open wire dropping down. This is what I was trying to really answer the question. Is it the same 5,000 ohms, or am I going to see something different there, over?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I think you're worrying a little bit unnecessarily, Mel. First of all, when it comes to the AEA, I'm assuming the AEA was made for a 50-ohm system. Therefore, it can probably tolerate, I'm going to pick a number, 6-to-1 VSWR of all possible phase angles. It can go down to 8 ohms of resistance and up to 400 ohms or something like that, 300. And then it starts going crazy. You can build yourself a whole set of standard terminations for the AEA, a 50-ohm termination, a 40-ohm, a 30-ohm, a 12-ohm, a 75-ohm, a 100-ohm, 150-ohm. You can build yourself a number of terminations for the AEA. To build a termination at 3.7 megacycles is quite easy. You don't even have to be careful about stray capacitance and inductance. You can find out how the AEA responds to each one of those loads. You can then start building slightly more complicated loads, a 50-ohm resistor with a 100-ohm capacitor reactant across the resistor, and look at the combination. You can plot that ahead of time on a Smith chart and know what it should be and find out what AEA reads. So step by step, you can find out what your AEA can tolerate and how it reads. You can literally go to the next step of calibrating everything your AEA reads and find out what it really is. So, let me drop. So by way of that, a whole bunch of phony loads, dummy loads, some with capacitance, some with inductance, maybe even put in a pure 50-ohm capacitor and a pure 50-ohm inductor and find out what AEA will say. You'll eventually find out the characteristics of your AEA and its accuracy. And if you don't like it, you can do the same thing with your noise bridge. Now, when it comes to the 30 feet of 600 ohm open wire line, you don't even really have to calibrate that line. You know the length of the line, you know the impedance of the line, you know the velocity factor of the line. Therefore, whatever you measure on the shack end of the line, with your Smith chart, you can easily figure out what's happening at the other end. If you wanted to calibrate that line, in your particular case, only one calibration is required. Simply put a short circuit across it at the top, right where it connects the antenna. That will be a double check of what you think the length of the line is. In other words, if you think it's 30 feet long and you put a short circuit at the end and you put a pulse down the line, you measure, does it take 60 nanoseconds to come back? Well, then it's 30 feet of line. If it takes 62 nanoseconds to come back, then it's 31 feet of line. That'll make a small difference as to how far you swing your compass on the Smith chart, if you know what I mean. These are minor perturbations. As far as what you measure versus the reality. If your antenna really is 5,000 ohms and you measured 4,820, in my opinion, that's close enough. That's put you in the ballpark. You're not exactly at home plate, but you're close enough. It's like halving the distance between you and Raquel Welch. The mathematician will say she never gets there. The engineer says she gets close enough for all practical purposes. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's what I did. I really took it for granted that I was so close that I know that the inaccuracy of that I was getting with that noise bridge, and I said to myself, I'm just not going to really, really concern myself. First of all, what more can I do with it? There's not much more I can do, with the antenna. I can't make it higher. I'm sure it's not going to make it lower. and I can't change the poles, the position of the poles or the support that I have. I'm happy enough that I was able to jam in this 272 feet in this situation here. So I said to myself, I'm just going to leave it go. The only thing that I did, remember, if you remember the experiment with the RF ammeter, when I put that RF meter into each line, a meter on each line, that's the only thing that started to throw me what exactly was taking place. Now, when I would be able to, in other words, with the using the Johnson kilowatt matchbox, remember, no transformer in there, I'm using link coupling. So now, when I swung that Johnson kilowatt matchbox and I adjusted it, they have a built-in SWR bridge in there, and a little bit off the conventional, it's not based on a piece of line in there, they have a whole different system in there. When I swung it into supposedly the lowest SWR, that showed me, at that point, in fact, I saw the current supposed to be basically, approximately the same. And all the guys I talked to, I said, tell me what's my signal doing. Signal went down. What do you mean my signal went down? Signal went down. It was stronger before. I said, gee, I think it was slightly out of resonance. When I get that thing slightly out of resonance, what you would, say more reading on one meter than the other meter. As soon as I do that, in fact, I got it at a point where not quite thrown completely out, but just move it out that one wire predominates the other, either or wire, whether I go higher or lower, the signal is stronger. Loading on everything, on transmitters, everything I checked, nothing changed. I looked at the scope, everything looked the same piece of pizza, everything. But that was what was throwing me. What the heck kind of effect that is, Nick, I cannot come up with the answer. Go ahead.
DC2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, I've got an explanation for that one, Mel. So go ahead, Glenn.
The reason I'm bringing this up, I saw the same exact effect, except I have one more piece of data to go along with that. In other words, on my loop antenna, normally if I tune it on most days, some days I get the best performance when I'm tuned exactly right on. Some days the signal reports are better if I have almost like a 2-to-1 VSWR, which is very, very strange. But one more piece of data that I found for that is that when I'm at perfect match on the tuner, I notice that the ground current, the current that's going from the radio, or the whole ground plane of the radio, to earth ground, increases and decreases. Depending on conditions outside, I would imagine. But on certain nights, I see very, very high current into ground from the system, and other nights, it's not. The tuning on the output's really the same. It's kind of an odd thing.
I don't think it's so odd. I think I've got an explanation. Both of you, when it comes to the full wavelength loop you've got outside your house, you cannot move it. You cannot shift it in polarization. If you were talking to a guy in Pennsylvania or if you're talking to a guy in London, that signal going through the ionosphere with Faraday rotation is going through some number of rotations. The possibility exists that when you issue a horizontally polarized signal on Long Island, it arrives to your buddy in Philadelphia as a vertically polarized signal. If he had a vertically polarized antenna and he sent it back to you, you would think vertical there would be horizontal here. It may be vertical when it comes from Philadelphia to New York, even though it's horizontal to vertical when it comes from New York to Philadelphia. Faraday rotation does not obey reciprocity. Some of the retuning, detuning that you guys were doing when you saw some standing wave ratio means that depending on the way your matchbox worked, this Johnson matchbox with this link coupling, gives him the ability to independently change the differential mode and the common mode. The current that you saw going to ground, Glenn, was common mode. I'm not sure that Mel has been measuring common mode. You have. As you go from pure differential feeding of your 600 ohm open wire line to pure parallel feeding of the 600 ohm line, in other words, you're putting the exact same voltage and the exact same phase on the left-hand wire and the right-hand wire, I call that common mode feeding. and you've got every other possibility in between. When you go from differential feeding to common mode feeding, you're changing the polarization of what comes out of the antenna, and you see a different impedance, which gives you some VSWR. Ordinarily, the VSWR is alarming. In this case, you could build an auxiliary network to correct for the VSWR for the common mode if you wanted to. I don't think you have to. So you were adjusting polarization. Mel has 1 degree more freedom when he's got that loop in the shack with him, his receiving antenna, because he can rotate it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. And he can max up the signal into his receiver for all three of those modes. You're doing something, you're doing the electronic equivalent of that, not all the way, but you're electronically doing that when you switch from the differential mode to the parallel mode and you start seeing current flowing in the ground. I wonder if that makes some sense, Glenn. Over to you, K2RIW.
No, it absolutely does. I guess just the part that kind of throws me is that I definitely realize the part that if you're changing the inductance and capacitance in the antenna, that's the amount of heat that's causing a phase shift, and yeah, certainly the rotation of the antenna is definitely, or the takeoff angles and everything coming out of the antenna is moving around quite a bit. The part that kind of surprised me a little bit is that there's no loose connections in the antenna. Everything is tight. You know, all the connections are good and solid coming all the way through. But why does the common mode current change from day to day as much as it does? Maybe that's the piece of the ground soil changing. I'm not really sure, but I don't have an answer for it. Back over to you, KB2QIQ.
Yeah, I think if you start correlating that to ground moisture, in other words, if you build yourself a device which consists of two different rods in the ground, you measure in an AC manner the ohms between the two rods, you would be measuring soil conductivity for that particular day. You probably will see a correlation between common mode current and soil conductivity if you don't change the tuning controls on the antenna tuner. Now, Mel has got... he's got the equivalent of an antenna tuner on the left-hand wire and an antenna tuner on the right-hand wire. So as he adjusts those, he's adjusting impedances, he's adjusting voltage ratios, he's adjusting phases. Whether he knows it or not, he's slowly sliding from the differential feeding mode to the common feeding mode or some kind of combination between the two. And periodically he sees VSWR in various settings, and there are times when he sees reasonably high VSWR, but the guy he's talking to says, hey, the signal just got stronger. Keep doing that. It's one of these situations where VSWR can be a false alarming circuit. Very similar to what happens when you are... drop. Let me drop. When you're adjusting the low noise characteristics of a gas-fed transistor. Common sense would lead you to believe that if I make the input impedance of the gas fed look like 50 ohms, I'm going to get maximum gain. That's the truth. You would assume with maximum gain you're going to get best noise figure. That ain't the truth. Every gas fed wants to see a particular impedance dot on that Smith chart, which is not 50 ohms. There's a particular impedance dot he wants to see that when you go there and you use your network analyzer on the input of that low noise preamp, you're going to see a 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, and that's the point of adjustment that gives you the lowest possible noise figure. What's going on there is that, yes, you've lost half a dB of gain because you've mismatched the impedance, but you gained 3/4 of a dB of improvement in noise generated by the transistor, and you came out a 1/4 dB ahead. As you mismatch the gas-fed transistor in just the right manner, you can make the noise go down faster, then the gain goes down, and you come out ahead. So no state-of-the-art gas-fed preamplifier is adjusted for a 50-ohm input impedance. By the same token, when you're adjusting this loop antenna, and you're looking for the right ratio of differential mode versus common mode to get the right polarization of radiation that gives you the strongest signal to that buddy of yours with the ionospheric state today at this hour, when you do that, when you maximize the signal that he sees, your buddy you're talking to, you, in many cases, if you don't have another third or fourth knob on your antenna tuner, you're going to have some common mode current flowing in the ground, and it's going to give you some VSWR, and it's going to alarm you. Yeah. The VSWR is giving you a fraction of a dB of loss, but the right polarization is making the signal 6 dB louder, and he says keep doing it. That's part of what I think is going on here. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech net.
You may be in on something, and I'll tell you why. This is K2KEY. One guy did get on, and he had a different explanation, basically, as to what's happening here. He said that, you know, there's confusion, I could say. A lot of nights, you know, I swing it a little this way. I'm actually, you know, adjusting it for listening. I hear it, you know, when I listen to the station when I get on, and I swing it a little this way, that way, and actually taking on the receive signal and saying, well, most likely my transmit signal will follow along. One of the guys came on and he says, you guys are wrong. You're not doing it right, though. He says, I came up with a better one. He says, I'm using what he's doing. He takes the, originally started out, he took the two 600 ohm wires and he connected them together up at the top. In other words, he made one continuous loop. He didn't, in other words, plot it like I did have. And Glenn has, where, you know, has a feed on either side of the insulator. He made one continuous loop, and he originally started out, he said, with two wires, the two wires, the 600 ohm wires, together at the top. Did the same thing down on the bottom, and made himself a tuner with a ground screen and a whole business. And he said, that takes care of many competing systems there with coax. I think he made up some kind of L network. There were, I know he used a rotary inductor and a variable capacitor in series, basically. Then he says, I improved upon it. He made himself a cage. He's got four wires now, separated a foot, 1 foot square cage, and he swears by it, that he says. And he remotely controls the adjustment of this box that sits right on ground. The case of the box is actually sitting on the ground screen, and he got right below this ground screen. He's got drove a rod. He can basically see the rod he drove in there. He thinks for protection against lightning. But he says it's quieter, and he says this way he can go right to the shack with coax. He says that this takes care of that problem, that effect, Dick, because he's essentially now grounding the system over.
Yeah, for lightning protection and static charge buildup, grounding is kind of good. And I predict that there are some days, and there are some directions of signal you want to talk to, the guy where you want to talk to is in some direction, that the common mode is the dominant mode for that particular guy. That really means you're feeding the left-hand wire and the right-hand wire of your 600 ohm open wire line, you're feeding the exact same voltage at the exact same phase. During the time you're feeding it common mode, there is no voltage across the wires. It's only voltage to ground, so to speak, and that wave is traveling up the transmission line. During that period of time, you could have a remotely operating relay that puts a dead short circuit across the top of the 600 ohm line, and nothing would happen. It would keep working the same way. When you're in the pure common mode, there's no voltage across the wires. You can short them out as many times as you want along that length, and nothing will change. Of course, that's not true for the differential mode, and most of the time, your ideal signal for a particular guy you're talking to is going to be some combination of differential and common mode feeding to that cable. Answer me this question, Mel. Have you ever seen a situation when you adjust the relative voltage and current on the left-hand wire and the right-hand wire, and you get the strongest signal report from Mr. A, we'll say in Philadelphia, and then Mr. B in Harrisburg says, gee, that's not the best. If you adjust it a little bit further over to the left, I saw a stronger signal. I wonder if you've ever seen that condition, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, this is K2KEY. Every time I've adjusted it, either, like I say, swung it through either on the low side of one wire or the other wire, I pulled the whole group, and one after another, they say, that's it, you got it, that's it, that's, you're much better. No such thing. It's either wire, that's it. It's got some kind of a, I don't know what to say, but I will say one thing. that, of course, I see the difference in the loading all the time. You know, when I could say when I get on, like tomorrow night, and I, of course, they already start the QSO, I just twiddle the knob a little bit this way, that way, and I have on my scope the peak reading on the spectrum display, and I just notch it up for one guy I know. He used to be the sensor. My friend Terry. When I notch it up on his, everybody else needs to follow. He's in, right outside of Pittsburgh at a place called Plumboro. And when I notch it up on him and I watch the peak, you know, on the scope, then it seems like the rest of them go along with that. He'll give me a signal report and that's it. And a couple of times I said, let me see what happens. So I just as I come back to him, he says, what do you do, you shut the amplifier off, Mel? What you do, change rigs or something? He says, it's just not there anymore. And I said, oh, wait a minute. And I know where the setting is on and off, and I just move it up. He says, uh-huh. He says, what you do, pushing a little bit more drive? It actually makes such a pronounced difference. That's it. But once it gets that peak, it's for some reason, for that night, it's perfect. It just stays that way. I looked. There's a lot of times the weather hasn't changed drastically. It has been cold or hotter or rain or snow that day or all. I mean, it could happen in the middle of the summer where the weather's been 85, 90 degrees every day. That's why I ruled out the possibility of something with the Earth side would take over.
222 QAQ.
Yeah, I'm going to go in a minute, Glenn, but I got a couple of questions here for Mel. You do see a difference in the proper settings from day to day, which could be ground conductivity, could be state of the ionosphere. I'm a little bit disappointed that you told me everybody wants the same setting. However, all the guys you're talking to are in one particular compass setting, all toward Philadelphia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, and whatever. They're all to the west. Have you ever simultaneously run a QSO with one guy in Maine, one guy in Florida, one guy in Pittsburgh, and one guy in London, so to speak? When they're widely dispersed on the compass, do they still all want the exact same setting for maximum signal? Over to you, Mel, and then turn it over to Glenn.
Actually, every night that's it. We've got a guy from Florida, Brady's in Florida, two guys. We've got a guy from Leesburg, Virginia. Another guy from North Carolina, Larry. Two guys from Pennsylvania. One guy from Alden, Mass. So, no, we're and as far as our furthest one is a guy from Texas, Doug in Texas, and let's see, that's 10-5-3-C. Just thinking, yep, you got the whole variety. The only thing I haven't got is anything is Eastwood, because I can't go, Eastwood has to be a DX station. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I have to completely agree with what Mel is seeing. I feel with identical performance. You know, when everything is tuned up and everything's working fine, everybody goes up overseas, DX, local, everybody hears you better. The other thing also is that what I've noticed is that, like Mel was saying, it's not so much like the weather or whatever it is, because on certain rainy days I've had great DXing, dry days, great DXing. But what I have noticed is when you receive conditions seem to change. You know, some nights you get such high static levels and other things. Those are usually the nights where my common mode noise, the common mode current, from the ground plane of the radio plane into the ground are the highest. And that's usually when things get nasty. And it's when those currents seem to come down in the tuning and I come back on. Wow, it's like some nights you just get on, you don't even have to turn the amplifier on and you can talk to just about everywhere. Back to you, QIQ.
If you could be correlating this with state of the ionosphere, maximum usable frequency, ionospheric density, whatever, versus the amount of common mode current for which everyone claims that they're seeing the strongest signal from you, I'd like to see if that's the factor. Different amounts of common mode current for different states of the ionosphere. About the only variables I can think of are ground conductivity and state of the ionosphere. At 80 meters, the ionosphere changes a whole lot from day to day. Mel, you do see from day to day different settings are required for everyone to get maximum signal. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Sometimes, sometimes not. I can't draw a line. That's what I said. I tried to correlate different things. Weather conditions, skip conditions. I tried with my, you know, some nights, as Glenn said, the noise level is deadly. It's terrible. So I used the receiving loop then. That's in the shack. I used that with a QRN squasher. So I tried to coordinate the two and say, well, maybe the noise level is higher. It has something to do with atmospheric. I don't know. Dick, I haven't been able to draw any conclusions. Every time I think I know something about my antennas, I get a curveball thrown at me, and this thing is... I have sat so many times and puzzled myself over this thing, what goes on with this antenna, you know. The receiving loop enough gave me, you know, enough things to think about because of how it works. But the outside loop, I mean, you know, you hear people making all kinds of comments about this and all kinds of variations of it. This guy tilting it, this guy doing this with it, and all, and everybody making all kinds of claims. And you start after a while, you know, questioning, what the heck is this guy doing that's supposed to, maybe he's got a better answer and all. But one guy insists that the cage system. Now, what is he accomplishing? Anytime anyone wants to come out there, he's out in Ohio, I'll show it to you, I'll prove it to you. By using four-wire cage as the drop line from the loop, same length as me, dropping down from 45 down to 10 feet above. No, he's going right to ground with it because he's got that box sitting on, that iron box sitting on that ground screen. Is there any validity in that situation that now he's got this 1 foot square area of feeders going down? Does that mean anything, or is this something that he just conjured up and over?
Yeah, he's got four wires coming out of his box on the ground going up to the antenna. Are only two of them going to the antenna, Mel? Go ahead.
All four. He's got them all four connected at the top, all joining together. He's got spreaders. He's got these PVC spreaders that cross each other. So he's got a 1 foot square box, and he's got four number 14 wires going up this thing. And they just join together and connect onto this continuous loop. And down at the bottom, they come together the same thing onto a big insulator, because he's got a big glass insulator, you know, one of these old fashioned beehive insulators on top of this iron box inside of this tuning network, which is actually, in other words, the tuning network is an L-type, I guess an L-type time tuning network. I forgot, I got the notes on what he told me about the network, I don't remember. But basically, that, and from there he goes, I'm going with the feeders right into the shackles, the external wire feeders. No, he's going down to this box, and from this box, he runs coax, Dick, over.
Okay. What he's got is a very low inductance probe to feed the antenna purely common mode. He could drop one piece of 14-gauge wire if he wanted to. By having a cage of four wires, he's making that length of wire a hell of a lot lower in inductance. And maybe that makes the impedance matching a little bit easier for his Pi L network or whatever is in that steel box, which converts it to 50 ohms, and then he feeds it with coax from there out to the shack, back to the shack. So many of the curtain-like antennas that were used in the early days of radio used a feeder like that, three, four, five wires in a cage, making it a much lower inductance feed. The inductance is not bad, just that it makes the impedance matching more complicated. And he is getting lower loss in that thing. He's got essentially no loss in that cage. But he's feeding his antenna pure common mode. Therefore, he's got lots of ground current if he wanted to measure it. The ground rod that's in that steel, under that steel box, is seeing lots of common mode current. And if I'm saying you correctly, Glenn, on the night that's noisiest, when you adjust for the strongest possible signal for the guys that are listening to you, the noisy nights are the nights that you have the greatest amount of common mode current flowing into ground. Is that what I think I heard you say earlier? Over to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Yes, that's absolutely it, Dick. And it really doesn't matter whether I'm tuned directly on in teams or slightly off. It just seems that a correction that will tend to loosen up some of that common mode current field, I can reduce it by screwing up the VSWR with it, just kind of like shifting it off center and get it from a perfect match to, you know, somewhere between 1.5 to 2 to 1, to, you know, back to the amplifier. The amplifier doesn't matter too much, but I have some tuning capability in there to kind of straighten things out a little bit again. But it tends to reduce the common mode current, but that's when I see the biggest problem. The nights where it's the noisiest and the hardest to kind of make contact. And the nights where it just seems where everything's clean and easy going, I have the least amount of common mode current. It just seems as if whenever I can tune out the common mode current, I always get the best possible performance. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, tell me the nature of your antenna tuner. Is it a link coupling network as a way of feeding your 600 ohm open wire line? Back to you, Glenn.
Dick, it's an MFJ989B. It has the roller inductor, basically two tuning cabs coming out of the basically tune that high L network, and it's basically from that I have two 75 ohm coaxial cables where the shields are tied directly to the antenna tuner box. I'm running coaxial cable from the antenna tuner out about 10 feet, and then it goes to right about the wall where there's the balun. Then the balun basically goes from 50 ohms up to 200 to 4 to 1, and then I attach the 275 ohm coax is right directly to the wing nuts on the balun, and the two shields get tied to the shield of the balun. And then that runs out about 50 feet out to the back of the house where the wire, where it runs up to the wire, and I just leave the shields tied together just as the two 75 ohm cables go to either side of the back to you there.
If I understand you correctly, you don't have any 600 ohm open wire line in your case. By way of the two 75 ohm cables, you have the equivalent of 150 ohm open wire line. Is that true?
Yes, it's very close to it. When I've measured it, characteristic impedance is very close to 150, but measured somewhere around 200.
And have you ever tried to, through that whole network, measure what you believe is the impedance of your loop? I'm assuming your loop is one wavelength long. And how far above ground is the loop, and what feeds it up at that high altitude? Go ahead.
Okay, the actual measured impedance that I've measured right on the antenna is just 200 ohms. It varies a little bit, not by a whole heck of a lot. The whole combined impedance is around 100, and it'll vary between 180 to 210. I've seen it on different days while measuring it. It's fed right at the top. The overall loop is relatively about 6 feet off of the ground, stapled to a picket fence along the backyard, and then from just as it comes up to the house, from the picket fence to the back, I have a piece of PVC pipe that's mounted about 4 feet above the roof, and then the wire makes a transition up to the piece of PVC at the top where I make the connection to the 75 ohm cable.
Fascinating antenna. Okay, we're at the bewitching hour. This was TechNet number 1181 of the series that began in September of 1982, a little more than 25 and a half years ago. 73-year-old, be kind to each other. Mel, time for you to turn on the whip, tie the ribbons on it.
It is a take. Well, I thank you all, and I know we didn't get to a heck of a lot of emails tonight, but I'll pick up on them and make sure next week that we do really spend some more time on emails. In the meantime, yes, the loop antenna is something I never expected what was going on. In fact, originally when I put it up, I thought I was really wasting my time. But I heard so much about it, I guess the curiosity is what got me. And it's still getting me curiosity what was taking place. I don't think we've got a complete answer yet on some of the effects. Okay, with that, good night all. 73. We'll talk to you next week. This is KCKY. Thank you.